This is a People First Radio podcast.
Luke Galati says that for 3 months, the psychiatric ward was his reality, and that he lost his freedom, but not his hope. Galati shared in a first-person piece for the CBC that he wants to demystify the experience of being hospitalized. He's also produced a radio documentary about bipolar disorder called Dreaming of Better. I got in touch with him to learn more.
So my name is Luke Galati. I'm a journalist and documentary storyteller. I have a background in making documentary films, especially in the areas of basketball culture and mental health.
Well, Luke, thank you very much for making the time to speak with me. You've written in a first-person piece for CBC that you want to demystify what being in a psychiatric ward is like, and I'm hoping you can take me through that experience today. Maybe what do you feel is the best place to kind of bring people into that story?
I guess the reason that kind of use that word demystify is because, like, when I was going to the hospital when I was struggling with my mental health, I didn't really know what to expect. Like, I think I just kind of expected, like, you know, a whole bunch of people who are like hysterical or who are, you know, like screaming and like violent. And that's not necessarily what I experienced. When I did go to the hospital, I've been to the hospital a few times struggling with my mental health. I live with bipolar. It can be scary, and for sure, like, the toughest place to be is where you start out, which is the ICU, which is the intensive care unit. And I'd say, like, if I was in that environment for a long period of time, it would have made it quite a struggle to get better, just because there's so many people who, you're in such a small area with so many other people who are, you know, just like having their own mental health challenge. It's almost like I don't use, the word that comes to mind is like being in like a soup full of just like ingredients that when put together can like not be good. I'm a little off track there, but.
Well, maybe you mentioned there you live with bipolar disorder. How would you describe that to people? What is bipolar disorder like?
For sure. So I have bipolar type 1. There's a different one. There's a type 2, which experiences more of the depression. So in my particular case, I experienced like mania or bouts of psychosis. So the interesting thing about it is that it's not all the time, but it's more episodic in nature. So, you know, like for me, I know my triggers are if I'm not eating like properly, if I'm skipping meals, that can kind of trigger it. Or if I'm not sleeping properly, or if I don't take my medication, then those are kind of the times where psychosis can happen and I can lose touch with reality, kind of experience like paranoia. And then, you know, if I'm not sleeping properly, then that kind of leads to, you know, me needing professional help. One of the things that I've also experienced, which was very helpful, was there was a program that I was doing where I would meet a social worker outside of my work every couple weeks, and she would check in on me. And, you know, it was casual, and it was something that helped. So that was one part of a radio documentary that I actually recently made about living with bipolar. And I also wrote an article about it with CBC.
Yeah, that radio documentary, it's called Dreaming of Better. I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about your experience making it.
Yeah, so it was part of a program that the CBC was running for people who live with disabilities. So there were three teams all making their own, you know, radio documentary. And for me, it was a new experience because I had an experience being a documentary filmmaker. So, you know, having the visuals along with the audio, but it was kind of a new challenge to create something, you know, just using audio. And by doing that, I kind of tapped into, you know, some experience that I had, you know, being in a mental health ward or psych ward, whatever you want to call it. But one of the, I'd say, most liberating parts of it was speaking with other people who have been through it. You know, I spoke with a lawyer, a young professional, a filmmaker, and also someone from America who he wrote a book about his experience, actually. It was really special because I got to kind of understand what other people went through. So that was kind of on a personal level. But then also on a professional level, I spoke with, you know, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, the social worker that worked with me, a mental health nurse. And I think, you know, it provided a story that hopefully, you know, if someone else, maybe their family member is in the psych ward, or maybe someone is in the psych ward, or maybe someone's like questioning whether they need to get mental health help, I hope that, you know, the work that I do can kind of help them to learn what they should expect. But also just to say that, hey, like, even if you do go through it and you go through a tough time, like, you will get out and there is hope.
Two pieces there you touched on, the people you interviewed about their own personal experiences and the professionals working in this system. And I want to ask you about each of those kind of separately. Maybe we'll start with that professional one. When you're going to chat with some people who were involved in some of your care, but also just experts in the field more broadly, what were the questions that you had for them that you wanted to ask, having had some of the experiences you've had?
Yeah. So a lot of the people who I spoke with were professionals. Almost everyone was actually someone who like was involved in my care. So I guess for me, it was like really interesting just to kind of hear from their perspective, because I know like what it was like in my mind. It was interesting, you know, even learning things like why the hospitals are so like sterile and kind of boring, to talking about how, you know, like there aren't enough social services to support people who are struggling, to, you know, speaking with psychiatrists who kind of demystify, you know, like a lot of people think that people who live with mental health challenges are violent, but that's not the case. They're actually more likely to be a victim of violence because people don't know how to deal with them. And also, you know, just hearing about even things like effects that medication can have on people, you know, like I think that's something that sometimes isn't talked about. And, you know, certain medications can have effects. I can personally speak to me, you know, like it made me gain a lot of weight when I was on a certain medication, and I would eat food and then I'd be so hungry right after. And, you know, that's something that if it isn't nipped in the bud, that can lead to other serious things like diabetes and just like health challenges. So I hope that answers a little bit, but I'm happy to dive into whatever else you'd like.
Yeah, you share in the documentary a little a bit of a piece on that medication front. You share a story that there was a time when you were in the hospital that you refused medication, and you kind of explained that some of those factors you just were speaking about were kind of considerations in your head. And I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, for sure. So I'd say like in the past, like there's been like forced medication through like needles. And I think like that was when I was like very sick and I was very unwell and I was kind of having like delusional thoughts. So, you know, I thought that like them giving me a needle was like going to be like poison, and that was like very frightening to go through. And there's also someone else who I spoke with in my radio documentary who went through something very similar with force being used. But you know, like I remember even one time I was in the hospital, I was like, oh, could you let me please know the side effects of this medication? And this was at a time where, you know, like I had to take the medication, and but they didn't tell me. But I don't know, like medication's kind of tricky because they're trying to get you out of it. But then like sometimes the side effects can be challenging, and yeah, it's a tough situation.
And you also shared that you interviewed a number of people who had their own experiences of bipolar. And I'm wondering if you could tell me, what were some of your big takeaways from those conversations?
I think I always knew it, but it was kind of validating to kind of learn that, like, you know, there are people who live with bipolar who can like be super successful and like cope with it. I think that sometimes when people hear like bipolar, they think like, oh, like they're crazy forever and like they're doomed. But like, you know, like I saw actually the exact opposite. You know, like there are people who you have to learn how to cope a little bit, but you know, you can be like incredibly creative. You can be incredibly professional. You can be a lawyer. You can be a filmmaker. You can be anything you want. I just think you just got to take that extra mile to really take care of you yourself and know what your triggers are. So it's not that I didn't know that people with bipolar can be successful, but it just kind of like affirmed to me that, hey, you got to take care of yourself and put yourself first. But you know, there is like the ability to live a very happy, successful life.
And you shared a little bit of a story of how this impacted you in terms of you've had this long line of work helping coach basketball, And when you first were experiencing some difficulties with your mental health, after that, the folks who you were coaching with, there was no problem, right? They were like, no, Luke, we get you. It's going to be okay. You didn't experience any kind of like negative stigma. You were able to keep doing that work.
Yeah, for sure. That was definitely a blessing because, you know, I love basketball. Basketball is like one of my greatest passions in life. And, you know, to be able to be around like young people and teach them and work with them. And then also to be able to be around, you know, the coaching staff who the head coach, he coached me when I was like 13 years old and went with him until I was 18 as a player. And then started coaching with him. And I've been doing that for a decade now. And kind of the fun thing about that is a lot of my friends, it's all like we coach, but we also socialize. There's about like five of us now. And we all stay around just for the camaraderie and to be able to see each other. And I think that's like a huge part of coping with mental health. Because, you know, I think when I went through an episode after I graduated from university, I felt very alone. And I felt like it was the first year after, you know, like not seeing your friends every day in school. And I just got out of the hospital and like I felt like I didn't really have as much like support. I did have support, but I felt a little bit alone. So, you know, for me being able to coach basketball and like have a social outlet that, you know, okay, I have this structure every week, I'm going to, you know, give back even in a small way. That's definitely gone a long way in helping me.
Earlier you shared that, you know, the first time you went to the hospital for psychiatric treatment, you really weren't sure what to expect. What were some of the things you would want to communicate with someone else who might be in those shoes down the road? What would you want them to know about what that kind of experience can be like?
I think I'd want them to know just like, this is temporary, you know, because like, I think like if you've never like been there before and you're being held like against your will or you're being held there, like even if you like do consent, I think just knowing that like, hey, this is like temporary. It's not like a forever thing. And it's something that, you know, you can get through. I also hope that, you know, someone in that situation has some kind of family, friends, or support who can like visit them. This might sound kind of silly, but one of the things that I would recommend if someone else was in like their kid was in the hospital or their friend or their partner, definitely like food is a big thing because like hospital food isn't great. And when you're in the hospital for a really long time, like you really, like I remember I got like my uncle brought me some pizza. It was like the greatest thing ever. So just like stuff like that. But just spending time with people, you know, like letting them know they're not alone. I think like often, I think there's like that expression that idle hands, you know, like creates challenges. And I do believe that's true. So when I was in the hospital, one thing that also helped me was like, I would listen to the radio all the time. So I'd listen to the radio, you know, pass the time by. It was also cool because like, you know, like the radio like hosts, they'd be like making jokes and like I felt like I was like not alone in that way. And then later when I wasn't in the ICU, you know, there was like a TV room so I could watch TV, pass the time. And you know, like even like doing things like reading books, like I think just like don't just like the advice I would try and give to someone is like, even though you are somewhere that you don't want to be and somewhere that can seem disastrous, you know, like still try and work on yourself if you can, you know, like read a book, do a puzzle, whatever you can, you know, just like, I think like if you just think about like, oh, poor me, then, you know, it'll reflect in your health. So I think like, even if you are going through the struggle, just try your best to stay busy and work on yourself.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh, and my guest is Luke Galati. He's a journalist and documentarian. He's sharing his experiences with bipolar disorder. Galati produced a radio documentary for the CBC about bipolar disorder. It's called Dreaming of Better. He also wrote a first-person piece for the CBC about a three-month hospital stay he experienced in 2023. We've been talking about both of those things on today's program. In your first-person piece that came out recently for CBC, you kind of walked through the evolution of your three-month stay And I'm wondering if you could tell me how things changed. Like, what you talked about, some of the ways you spent time in the hospital. How did that kind of stay evolve over 3 months?
Yeah. So it started in the ICU, and then eventually, once I started showing progress and getting better, and also probably they maybe had a space open up because they're very in demand, unfortunately. I went up to the 17th floor at a hospital that I was staying at, and yeah, like, I guess just, you know, me, I feel like this expression I've used before, like, I feel like my brain kind of needed to cool down. So, you know, like, from like taking medication and then resting, you know, having visitors, just slowly started getting better, you know, just like, it's not, for me, at least in this case, it wasn't a short stay. It was 3 months, which was quite long. But, you know, like, I was still trying to do things to stay, like, entertained, stay working on myself. I was doing some writing. I started writing, like, a book. For me, that gave me some purpose and structure. You know, just, I just needed my brain to cool down. So I think, like, by taking that time and, you know, trying to get better in a place where, you know, it can be pretty stressful. And you're surrounded by people who, I still remember, like, some shrieks of people screaming and, like, fights breaking out. And it's not always like that, but I guess you got to just try and, like, focus on yourself, really. Cause if you focus on other people, then, you know, you can't control that.
Would you be able to tell me what the decision to go to the hospital was like?
Yeah. So, must have been like early January, 2023. And, I missed my medication for a few days, which is really uncharacteristic for me. And then, you know, like, I wasn't sleeping properly. I was like barely sleeping. I was skipping meals. And then, you know, I actually had a therapy appointment, thankfully. It was a virtual appointment with a therapist who I've worked with for a number of years. And she could tell that I was off and that I needed support. So she recommended that I go to the hospital. So I ended up going, getting a ride downtown in Toronto to the hospital. I still remember the I guess emergency room, like, area was so erratic and loud. And eventually I got saw, and then, from there I was checked in, and then, yeah, that was kind of the process of entering.
Was there anything about, like, when you made that decision, when you say your therapist suggested this is something you should do, what was it like between, you know, hearing that and then deciding, yes, I'm going to do this, to go to the hospital?
Yeah. You know, I think first of all, I trust my therapist because I've worked with her for almost a decade. Not quite, but I've worked with her for a long time and I trust her judgment. And also, like, I could recognize in my own behavior that, like, I needed help and I needed support. And I think also, like, you know, having previous hospitalizations, like, I'm more able to kind of, like, identify the help that I need now. I think, like, before I may have, like, not understood it as well. Whereas I think I made some progress in terms of, you know, like, recognizing that, hey, like, you need help and there's no shame in that. So yeah, that's kind of what I'd say for that.
You share in your documentary Dreaming of Better that there was a time when it was suggested like to try some group therapy, and it was something you weren't sure about. And then the process of talking with other people in the course of making the documentary, other people with experience of bipolar, that really changed something for you and made you like even more open to the idea of telling your story. And I'm wondering if you could tell me about that.
Yeah, I think this would have been when I was about 21 or 22 years old. I was offered to do group therapy, and it was something that I just wasn't sure if I'd feel comfortable, like, telling my story, like, to kind of strangers. I kind of felt like it'd be intimidating, and I just wasn't really at that point where I felt ready to do that. But when I was in university doing my Master's of Fine Arts in documentary media, I told a story in relation to police responding to people in mental health crisis. And I kind of made like the comparison, like, you know, for me being like a journalist and a artist and filmmaker and storyteller, you know, like if other people are vulnerable to tell their stories, then, you know, I feel like I should be as well. And, you know, I think that like by being vulnerable, you know, like people can relate to that. And coming back to this radio documentary that I made called Dreaming of Better, it kind of reminded me of, you know, like the time back in the day when I was offered to do group therapy, because it felt like when I was doing these interviews, it almost was a form of therapy for me, because, you know, I'd like learn from their perspectives and have a lot to relate to, or, oh, wow, I didn't experience that, but, you know, I could see how that would happen. So, yeah, I think just by being vulnerable, you can gain a lot from it. And now, you know, if I were to be offered some kind of group therapy or to work with other people who have gone through it, I think it's something that I'd be open to.
How did you take the tools that you'd studied when you're learning about doing a master's in documentary filmmaking, and then you approach this idea of sharing a bit of your own story, talking to people about bipolar? How did you use those tools, or what were the parts of like studying storytelling that you applied to telling your own story?
For sure. I'm not exactly sure where I learned this, but the one thing that I kind of learned from making documentaries, like every good story, I think has a through line, so to speak. It has something that takes you from the beginning, the middle, to the end. And, you know, in the two documentaries that I've made about mental health, you know, I've been the through line. So, you know, like I introduce my story, I talk to other people, my story, other people. So I think that by, you know, like using myself as the vehicle in my experience to then speak to other people and then use some of the other skills that I've developed, like interviewing, you know, like incorporating music, sound bites, and, you know, storytelling, it's created a way for me to, you know, like use the best parts of my education with also my passion and with something that I think will help Canadians and hopefully people around the world. So yeah, I think like just by having a through line, so to speak, like even in like my films that have been about basketball, for example, I made a film called Eastern. It was about Toronto High School Eastern Commerce. The through line of that story was basketball in the team's final season before the schools closed down. But for this documentary that I made, Dreaming of Better with CBC, I was the through line where I would tell my story, and then in between, from the beginning to the end, we would speak to different people, you know, people who have gone through it, people who are helping other people, people who work in the medical system. So that's kind of how we and how I wanted to approach that story.
Still on that front of storytelling, if you were put in charge of some kind of like mental health education or awareness campaign, what are the things you think it's especially important that those campaigns do?
I think that one thing would be to focus on all types of mental health challenges. I think sometimes like there are certain mental health like conditions that are more spoken about, I think, that are maybe a little bit more like easy to tell. But also I think that, you know, one thing that I think would be really cool if one day the CBC would have like a whole section just on healthcare. You know, I think they have that for some other groups in Canada. So I think like if they even just had like a disability page where, you know, you could like find all the stories that are related to disability in Canada, that would be really valuable. Because I can't remember what the stat is, but I want to say like 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 Canadians have a disability. So, you know, it is a huge group of people that have a disability of some kind, whether it's physical or with mental health. So I just think more coverage. And also I think it's kind of a community, you know, people with disabilities that's underrepresented. And I think it's also a group that, you know, like they do face a lot of oppression in many ways. I even think about, OSP, that's in Ontario, that people get when they live with disabilities, the amount is so little. And I think like one of the big hypocrisies was when it was COVID, you know, people got CERB. It was, I think it was like $2,000 every month or every 2 weeks. I don't quite recall. But then people who live with disabilities, they get like $1,300 a month to live on, which is next to impossible. So yeah, those are just some thoughts.
That idea that we have all of these mental health awareness campaigns and there has been a lot of maybe societal progress, I'll say, on talking about like certain mental health conditions, but there remains a lot of stigma or like other mental health conditions that people don't speak about. That's something that's come up a number of times in interviews I've done over the last year. Folks have said that things like bipolar disorder or obsessive compulsive disorder, there is still a sort of bigger stigma. What are the things that you think we need to bring more into the open or like provide more education or awareness on? Like, how can we get past that?
That's a great question. I think one way is like for people who live with like these conditions to also be able to tell their stories. I think that's like a big thing, you know, because like I do believe that like journalists and storytellers can do amazing jobs like for communities that maybe they're not a part of. But I think, you know, like having more people who live with conditions like bipolar to be able to tell stories like of that community could go a long way. I also think that, you know, it's something that a lot of people don't talk about. So it's like if you don't talk about it, how are people gonna like have that representation? And also even just like talking about like the doc I made, it was amazing. I got like feedback from all over the country, people being like, oh, I felt like really represented, or like this was an amazing way for me to like not feel alone. Or people being like, oh, wow, I didn't know you went through that. You're actually the first like person that I've met that's like openly talked about it. I hope that in this radio documentary and written article that I did that it'll just make it a normal conversation instead of something that maybe is taboo or something that is uncomfortable for people. I think also just, you know, being exposed to it and like someone from your community that you know and hopefully respect, that it just normalizes it, you know? It doesn't have to be a huge campaign. It can just be a simple click.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh, and I'm speaking with Luke Galati. He's sharing some of his experiences with bipolar disorder. Galati put together a radio documentary called Dreaming of Better. In the doc, he spoke with a number of the professionals who treated him while he was in hospital. He also interviewed other people about their own experiences with bipolar disorder. You can listen to it for free online. Just search Dreaming of Better, Bipolar. If someone does know someone in their life who they know has gone through experiences with a condition like bipolar disorder, and they're kind of curious and they want to know more about that person's experience, but they're also kind of worried about like not wanting to pry or not wanting to like make someone really uncomfortable, how would you suggest someone can go about asking about these kinds of experiences in a good way?
Sure. Honestly, I would just be casual and just be like, I don't know, maybe if you've like watched a movie about it recently, or you like read an article, even just being like, oh, like I came across this, I was wondering, what do you think of it? You can kind of bounce it off like that. Or you can just say, hey, like I know that you went through this. Like what was that experience like for you? Just leaving it open-ended. And then I think that gives the person, you know, with the lived experience, to either say, they can either talk about it, which you never know, they could be really wanting to talk about it. Or they could just say, oh, I don't really want to talk about that. And that's fine too. I just think like, don't be scared, you know? It's not like they're the boogeyman or anything. It's just like, just a normal thing. I would just be casual about it. And sometimes it's actually probably nice to be asked about it, because it's something that they might not talk about other than with like the closest people in their lives or maybe their care providers. So I think that, just be open.
Are there any parts about the experiences you've shared? So we started off our conversation talking about some of the experiences you shared in hospital for treatment. Are there any things you wish people would ask you about that experience?
Not quite. I wouldn't say so, but I would say that one thing that I think is really missing in the medical system is when you're in the hospital is like talk therapy. I really do think that that would go a long way. I think that, you know, in the hospital, like it's very medication focused and not so much like talking through your challenges. Like, so I think that like, if I could change one thing about the medical system and like the mental health ward or the psych ward, whatever you want to call it, I think it would go a long, long way if there was someone like a therapist that you could talk to about like your experiences and that you could really work through your issues with. Because sometimes when you're in, like in my experience, it would be like, okay, 5-minute conversation, done, medication, that's it for the day. But I think that like if the healthcare system could incorporate like talking through your challenges, challenging beliefs, thinking about like, you know, what could have led to the situation, that would go a long way. So I know I didn't really answer your question, but that's just one thing that I just wanted to kind of advocate for.
That makes a lot of sense. Earlier, you were talking about some of the things you were doing in hospital, like listening to the radio, writing out. In your CBC article, you talked about like a ball you got to bounce. Just there, you said that it was kind of like you would go and you would chat with a medical professional for like 5 minutes, maybe you'd update some things, maybe take some medication. How much of the time you spent in the hospital was just kind of like, you're on your own, it's up to you. And then like, maybe if there are visitors, you can talk to them. But if not, you just kind of got to figure it out.
Yeah, I would say that's a kind of a huge part of it. Like you see the doc, you get your medication, you eat breakfast. Usually the doctor will come before the afternoon. Usually it's a pretty short conversation. And then you're kind of left on your own, in my experience. Obviously, then you have lunch, dinner. So yeah, I just think that like if they had a little more time for people, or if they incorporated like therapists on some level who could maybe help you work through challenges that you're having, that would go a really long way.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation on this today?
I would just say, if you know someone who maybe has struggled and maybe like they acted in a strange way or they did something you might not understand, I would just like talk to them about it. Because, you know, the way you act, at least the way I've acted, like if I'm experiencing mania, like isn't representative of, I guess, like my mind when I'm in a clear state. So I just say, you know, like have those conversations with people and don't be like scared. One of the greatest things that's actually happened recently is I reconnected with one of my childhood friends who, when I was like experiencing mania, I was like, I thought he was like stealing from me, when I know he would never, ever do anything like that. And he's like one of the, like a really good guy. And we reconnected recently. We play basketball all the time now. I had one time when I was like in between games, I was just like, hey, I just wanted to apologize for, you know, like for when I like was not in a clear mind, because, you know, like you're a really good friend and like I didn't want to offend you, and like it's okay now. So I think just like giving, if you know someone who maybe has gone through that, I would give them grace and maybe just reach out. And then if you've done something that maybe you're experiencing mania, or I would just say try and have that conversation yourself too, because I think people are more understanding than you might think.
On that front of experiencing mania, is there anything you could share about either like what that is like, or what you feel, you know, in maybe societal discourse, what you would want people to know about the idea of mania?
Yeah, for sure. So I'd say like when I've experienced mania, one of the greatest things is like misintentions. So you, like one thing that I've gotten was like, I was paranoid about other people. I thought that like they were like trying to poison me, or like I thought that they like had bad intentions, when like they don't. And then I guess like what I try to explain to people is like, you're in a state of mind that isn't like, it isn't representative of what's going on around you. And like, it can be quite frightening. But like the thing is, like, eventually people will come out of it in the vast, vast majority of cases. So I'd just say, like, it can be, I would also say for people who maybe are like loved ones or friends or have a relationship with a person who's gone through mania, I would say just like be patient with them, because they like, they aren't in a state where they can quite like advocate for themselves sometimes. So I would just like be patient and don't take it personally.
We've talked a lot about a documentary you've made today. You're a journalist, a documentarian. If people have been listening and they want to go check out some of your work, what's the best way for them to do that? Where can they look?
For sure. So you can check out my Twitter. It's at Luke Galati, at LukeGalati. I also have a website, lukegalati.com. And yeah, you can. I'm also on Instagram, just Luke Galati, LukeGalati. And yeah, hoping to work on some new projects and just keep going.
Well, Luke Galati, thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Luke Galati is a journalist and documentarian. We were speaking about some of his work and some of his experiences with bipolar disorder.
People First Radio, People First Media, and People First Stories are community media projects of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and are produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast, podcast, and social media partners.